You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When the Supreme Court upheld the power of Congress to enact most provisions of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act in 2012, it also ruled that it was up to each state to decide whether to expand Medicaid eligibility, and 19 states chose not to do so. In a recent article for the New York Times Magazine called Life in Obamacare's Dead Zone, Inara Verzemnik's a journalist and assistant professor in the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa, looks at the Americans who have been excluded from the health care guaranteed to them by the law. And also joining us is Professor Heidi Castaneda, a medical anthropologist at the University of South Florida, whose work and forthcoming book from NYU Press is called Covered: Risk, Inequality, and Experiences of Healthcare Reform in the United States. And in it, they examine the lives and experiences of Americans who have been left out of the healthcare reform, the so-called coverage gap. I'm very pleased to welcome both of them to our show now. And let's start off with the obvious question. Why did the Supreme Court leave the decision to expand Medicaid up to each state? Heidi?
Yes. Well, you know, the Supreme Court ruled on one portion of the law, one of the more controversial portions, which, you know, included the Medicaid expansion in various states. And ultimately what the Supreme Court decided was that each state could choose whether or not they wanted to do this expansion. So what we got was a very uneven landscape at the end of the day, in which some of the poorest states and some of the states that had the lowest rates of health care insurance were, in fact, those who remained without expanding Medicaid.
Did the ACA's architects predict that this might happen?
Absolutely not. This was not part of the initial plan. It was expected that there would be a very uniform rollout across the country, and that uniform rollout would have helped to boost and support the ideals behind the reform. And so with the Supreme Court decision, we saw a very uneven landscape unfolding across the nation, and again, affecting many of the working poor who really needed the health care insurance or expanded Medicaid the most.
Inara, you write that 19 states opted for ideological reasons not to expand Medicaid, arguing that they are, quote, pushing back against government bloat and the fostering of dependency. How does it affect people with the lowest incomes in those 19 states?
It absolutely affects them profoundly. The terrible irony at the heart of this is that one of the other ideological reasons often cited is not to foster dependency. And yet, in many cases, having the opportunity to have access to insurance would give people the opportunity to help take care of themselves. For example, one of the people that I spoke to for the story is a young woman who was widowed in her 20s, who is now supporting her two daughters, trying to go back to school, trying to become a nurse. Nursing school requires you to have insurance if you are enrolled. And she's in a gap state. She can't afford insurance without the extra help that would have been provided if only she lived somewhere else where they had decided not to expand.
And you write that these people are caught between two non-options.
Mm-hmm.
What are they?
Yeah. So the non-option is essentially they have been excluded from qualifying for Medicaid. The architects of the ACA, their hope was that Medicaid, often in many states, is so restricted and very, very difficult for people to qualify for. So the idea was universally, uniformly, everyone who made 138% of the federal poverty level or below would qualify, and that would be across the board in every state. That would take care of those folks in that particular income bracket. Then they thought those who made 138% or above, they would go ahead and be served by the marketplace. And at that point, at that particular income level, there would be subsidies and tax credits that would kick in. They saw that that was the way that both would be taken care of. Well, when states decided not to expand, they left those out of those who would have been hopefully qualified for Medicaid out in the cold. And then they also, though, the situation was they couldn't go on the marketplace and get those tax credits and subsidies. So someone making even just a little bit more than they do, for example, might get back a quote that was much more affordable than something that they would receive.
The New York Times reported that as of last year, in Vice President-elect state, Indiana, many Medicaid enrollees can't get full benefits unless they pay monthly premiums. And if they fail to pay, some can be shut out of coverage entirely for 6 months. Often, if they go to the emergency room, they have to pay a fee. Interestingly, Seema Verma, the person who negotiated those provisions with the federal health officials, has just been chosen by Donald Trump to lead the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which oversees Medicare, Medicaid, and the Obamacare insurance markets. Does that suggest that we're going to see some serious changes in the near future? Hello?
I certainly believe so. I mean, I think the law is actually considered to be much more radical than it is. It's actually a very pro-market law that depends on the insurance industry and benefits them to some degree. But the rhetoric around the law has been very striking in its nature, and often has blamed Obama and the federal government for things that ultimately are happening at the state levels and the policies that are created and enacted at the state levels.
Now, officials have said that 4 million people have chosen ACA health plans by the start of this week, new people, and they've extended the open enrollment for four more days.
Mm-hmm.
So does that suggest that things have changed a bit?
I think people are quite nervous. They're nervous that they might be losing health insurance that they now have come to embrace. The HHS has reported that 4 million people have signed up this open enrollment period, and they expect to sign up about 1 million more between now and Monday if all goes well. So they've extended that deadline because there is a demand for affordable health care insurance in this country, and that's something that I think we shouldn't lose sight of, that really is one of the larger humanitarian crises that we face in this country, and that people really would like to have affordable and quality health care insurance.
My guests are Dr. Heidi Castaneda and Inara Verzenido. Verzemnix. I really did practice your name, and there shouldn't have been any problem. And then, of course, I'm on the air and I'm messing it up. Heidi, do we know anything about the ages and ethnicities of the people who are caught in the coverage gap?
Well, some of the poorer states around the country are the ones that are most affected. And in many cases, these are states with, for example, if you look at some of the southwestern states, I work particularly in Texas, there we have large Hispanic populations that are excluded from this. So it is in many ways disproportionately affecting ethnic minorities around the country.
But also people who are older, not yet 65?
Yeah, people right in that cusp, where they're sort of entering a period in their life where they may have more health concerns suddenly that they're facing.
And Ara, didn't you find that about a quarter of the people in the coverage gap are supporting children?
Yes, and that is, that's something that I think is really very difficult. Children, luckily, we have CHIP. Children children themselves are insured. But for example, I met a number of grandparents taking care of grandchildren. And that is such a tenuous situation. Certainly the children are insured, but you're the primary caregiver. Everything is dependent on you. And suddenly, you're aging, you're concerned about your health. What do you do if something happens to you? You have been the last option for these particular individuals. And so there's a tremendous amount of emotional strain, too, that people are under, just trying to hold everything together.
And you found that most people in the gap with jobs work full-time. What kind of work are they doing? Why aren't they covered by insurance from their employers?
In many cases, you're dealing with people who perhaps work for an employer where there aren't enough employees to trigger the particular requirements. seasonal work, a lot of people who are working in retail, a lot of people who are doing self-employed, for example. One woman that I spoke to has run her own housekeeping business for almost 30 years, and she is someone, for example, who falls into the gap.
Heidi is a medical anthropologist. Oh, you wanted to say something more, Heidi?
Oh, sorry. I just wanted to add that many people are working multiple part-time jobs where there is no requirement for insurance. For those, so people may be working two or three jobs, but if it's under the 30 hours a week threshold, the employer is not required to provide it. And that's often what's happening for a lot of these working people.
Now, Heidi, you're a medical anthropologist. Do you follow communities where a significant number of people are uninsured? There are certain kinds of communities that are most affected?
Yeah, and the book that you mentioned earlier, it's a collection of several medical anthropologists, social scientists who are doing this around the country, looking at different states and comparing those states. So yes, a lot of the states, a lot of the comparison that we're looking at is between the non-expanding states and the states who have agreed to Medicaid expansion, in order to see those differences. But beyond that, I think the goal for a medical anthropologist or a social scientist is to complement what we see in statistical data or big data that is often relied upon in health policy circles, and to contribute a sort of an on-the-ground look at how communities, how families, how individuals are going through the process of trying to obtain insurance coverage of some sort, and sort of following that and putting it in context of their larger lives, you know, their work circumstances, their family circumstances, their community circumstances, and sort of understanding in a sort of more in-depth qualitative way how these processes are occurring in these communities.
How is the experience of being uninsured today different than it was prior to the ACA?
Well, healthcare costs keep rising in many cases. So people often, when you talk to them, are saddled with very high bills if they have to go to the emergency room for things that are urgent but maybe not necessarily life-threatening. And if they don't have health insurance coverage or any other form of care, they might go to the emergency room and then are facing $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 bills that then spiral out of control, putting them into debt. And oftentimes, any sort of health issue will also prevent them from working full time, and so you get wrapped up in this spiral of debt and of inability to work that just sort of mutually reinforces itself and really tears apart communities and families in certain parts of this country.
There are so many people too who also, you know, have what begin as very sort of treatable issues, and as Heidi said, they so fear then, for example, racking up bills. Maybe they got so bad they had to go to the emergency room, and now they have this, you know, they've been getting calls from collections, and so they just don't go anymore. They don't go to the doctor. They're fearful of that, and then what was something that was very treatable suddenly becomes absolutely debilitating.
I'm speaking with Inara Verzemnics, whose article Life in Obamacare's Dead Zone appeared in the New York Times Magazine on the 11th of this month, and Dr. Heidi Castaneda, a medical anthropologist. She is a contributor to a forthcoming book called Covered, and that will come out from NYU Press. We'll take a little break and come back with more. We're back with Inara Verzemnics, whose article Life in Obamacare's Dead Zone appeared in the New York Times Magazine on December 11th. She is an assistant professor in the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa. And also with us is Professor Heidi Castaneda, a medical anthropologist at the University of South Florida, who contributed to a new book from NYU Press called Covered, Risk, Inequality, and Experiences of Health Reform in the United States. And Inara, you traveled through Missouri and Kansas and met with people who aren't covered. Can you tell us about Janet Foy?
Yes, Janet is one of the people I spent some time with, and one of the things I just kind of want to preface by saying is that I really believe in a certain kind of reporting where you take time to be there to watch sort of the quiet unfolding of people's lives. So I was very fortunate that Janet let me into her life and allowed me to just sort of see how she copes in the day-to-day.
Why didn't she qualify for Obamacare?
she is someone right now who she has had a string of difficulties and coping with depression, trying to kind of have the opportunity to bounce back from that. So she hasn't been working. And so she is someone who does not qualify for Medicaid in her particular state. That's a state that didn't expand. So as a single woman with no children, that's something that she is not eligible for. And then on the other hand, she doesn't have enough income to be able to purchase insurance on the marketplace.
You found that Medicaid is available in Missouri only if you fit the criteria that is sometimes called poor and, meaning poor and pregnant, poor and disabled, et cetera. Why would it not apply to a single childless middle-aged woman like Janet?
That's a very good question. why would it not?
This October, investigators from the Department of Health and Human Services' Office of Inspector General criticized Medicaid for estimates of questionable billing since 2012, totaling more than $600 million, and yet it's still not available to people who need it most? Are there problems in the way that Medicaid is being run at the federal level? Heidi, do you know?
Well, I would say that, you know, we have to be careful of some of these allegations. Oftentimes, allegations are put into place because, you know, out of political opposition. And I think certainly it's a large program that requires a lot of oversight. The ACA intended for a lot of this to happen at the state level, where there would have been other types of controls going on as well. But again, that was blocked by the states who decided not to expand the program.
You've been studying the lives of uninsured people in Hidalgo County, Texas. Why does Hidalgo County have one of the highest rates of uninsured residents in the country?
Well, I think it goes back to the issue that these are primarily working poor in an area that is does not have a wealth of jobs that pay well, and so people are not earning enough for the subsidy programs. And they also, of course, in being in a non-expanding state, don't have access to the adult Medicaid that would be available to them in other states. You know, for example, in New York. And so it's a region that has very very few high-paying employment options, and people are working for the most part, and often working more than one job, but are not under any obligation from their employers or, through the Medicaid system to obtain any kind of insurance coverage.
How are citizens and immigrant families affected by the complex enrollment process?
Well, it's quite complex in that some immigrant people will qualify for the ACA and its subsidies and the marketplace insurance exchanges, and others do not. It depends on how long people have lived in the country. There are some restrictions on immigrants who have been in the country fewer than 5 years. And, of course, undocumented persons, which number about 11 million in our country, are also excluded from any benefits under the ACA.
You told them. Go ahead.
And so in a lot of immigrant families, you have mixed opportunities for obtaining coverage. So children might be able to access the SCHIP programs, the children's health insurance programs. Other individuals might be eligible to receive, to look for insurance on the marketplace. And then other family members may be excluded entirely. And so it becomes a complex picture. And in some cases, we've seen that immigrant parents might be hesitant to enroll their children in programs as well because of out of fear of interacting with state programs.
Heidi, didn't you tell Inara for her article, no one is dying in the streets, but the uninsured are dying younger. People's life expectancy is affected. People's ability to work is affected.
Yeah, I think what I meant to express with that is that there's not a sense of outrage in this country over the fact that so many people are being affected by a lack of access to care, that the fact that we have huge levels of health inequality in our country is often masked because people can go to charity services for one mm-hmm. thing or the emergency room for another. But on the whole, people are very much affected, like I said, through their life expectancy, through the really high levels of chronic disease in this country that emerge from a lack of access to regular care. And the fact that we don't see visceral pictures of people suffering because these are very slow-moving chronic conditions that kill people and that shorten their life expectancy and then shorten their ability to work and support their families. And so it sort of masks the problem, the fact that, you know, intermittent care in some situations doesn't show the full picture of health inequalities in this country.
How important are informal health care providers in places like Kansas City, where Janet Foy lives? Does she have to rely on those because she can't go to the usual places?
Yes. I mean, there is an incredible network of people devoted to helping those who are uninsured and doing the best they can in these particular situations. But as one woman told me, for example, we basically have to say to a certain degree, don't get sick until maybe something will change and you might qualify for Medicaid. That said, there's a group, for example, out of the Samuel U. Rogers Clinic, which is based near where Janet lives, a federally qualified health center. And they've decided that one of the best ways to help those individuals who fall in the gap is to embed themselves in their everyday lives. And so they work on site at apartment complexes in the area, and they're there. So, for example, if they happen to see someone who they know maybe has some issues with high blood pressure, they can go ahead and say, hey, come on, let me go ahead and put this cuff on you and get a reading right now, just to kind of monitor, to do whatever they can. They've held classes on site in terms of helping people to reduce their stress, classes to help people figure out how to eat the healthiest possible meals that they can, maybe on a limited budget. They've arranged for a farmer's market to come to the particular complex and, you know, provide fresh fruit and vegetables to folks there. But really, in the end, you know, this is, it's helping. But much as Heidi said, the other thing is that it sort of creates a kind of buffer around the situation where, you know, still there are deep health needs that people have that they aren't able to meet because they fear or are unable to go to the doctor.
I'm speaking with Inara Verzemnics, who is a journalist, assistant professor in the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa, and the author of an article that appeared in the New York Times magazine on December 11th, Life in Obamacare's Dead Zone, and with Professor Heidi Castaneda, a medical anthropologist at the University of South Florida, contributed to a new book from NYU Press called Covered: Risk, Inequality, and Experiences of Health Reform in the United States. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Inara, you traveled from Kansas City, Missouri, and then through Kansas, and write that the area had already established something of a reputation in medical and health policy circles even before the emergence of the gap for the innovative ways its providers had adapted to the overwhelming demands of treating the uninsured and medically isolated. There are people out there who are filling a need because government is not helping?
Well, it used to be. One of the things that was very interesting in talking with people who worked in public health policy circles in the 80s, even into the 90s, if people were trying to figure out, for example, how to help the medically isolated in rural areas, Kansas is one of the places that they would think of. But what we've seen over time is sort of a shift, not even so much in the federal government, but in terms of state politics, and a real kind of clamping down on funding for these kinds of social service enterprises.
But hasn't Governor Sam Brownback of Kansas received a lot of criticism for the cutbacks that he has been responsible for?
Yes. I mean, one of the fascinating things that has emerged in terms of groups that are attempting to sort of rally support and understanding of the need to expand Medicaid, what they found is that Kansans, by and large, when they were polling, supported expanding Medicaid. So there's definitely pushback in the state of people who perhaps have voted Republican and yet at the same time disagree with the particular ideology concerning helping those who are falling into the working poor.
In a state like Kansas, are people in rural areas more affected by the coverage gap?
Yes, and that tends to follow simply because oftentimes, again, we're dealing with people who perhaps have seasonal employment, working in the agricultural industry, people who are stringing together several different jobs in the off-season. But also, too, you have a situation where perhaps it's you know, you got to drive 20, 30 miles to get to the nearest clinic, and that is very prohibitive for some folks. And so these issues sort of compound themselves in terms of the effect
Heidi,
on the uninsured.
Heidi, given the fact that Republican Party policies in these states have prevented low-income residents from having health care, why do the voters in those areas continue to vote for Republican representatives and leaders?
Yeah, I think some of the anger is directed, you know, anger and resentment is directed straight at the executive branch and at the federal level rather than at their state representatives and the state level where some of these policies are emerging and some of the decisions are emerging. You know, I think Inara is correct that some people, you know, people don't buy the Republican ideology wholesale. A lot of people are very interested in obtaining affordable health care, and especially now that we're into the ACA's implementation several years, people are seeing some of the benefits, and that's why they're worried that their health care might be withdrawn from them in some cases.
And Republicans in Congress appear to be set on repealing the Affordable Care Act. The replacement plans that they have proposed so far might leave millions of people without insurance and make it harder for sick or older Americans to access coverage. Have you looked at any of the plans? Would any of them, the ones that have been made public so far, maintain the Medicaid expansion as Obamacare envisions it?
Well, I think the proposals are very piecemeal in the sense that they want to keep some of the popular parts of the Affordable Care Act, such as not excluding people with pre-existing conditions. But they don't want to keep some of the parts that make it, you know, reasonable to keep. For example, if you don't have a certain amount of people in your insurance pool, the insurance industry is not going to want to participate in these plans. So by only keeping some of the more popular portions, but not those that, you know, make it feasible for the insurance industries to be involved in the Affordable Care Act, the bottom is going to kind of fall out. So it's you know, all of the pieces are sort of wrapped up together. The idea that everybody should obtain insurance helps to ensure that there is a pool of healthy people included in the insurance system. And so by removing some of those requirements, you really, you know, the bits and pieces of it don't work without the whole.
And Ari, you wrote about Cindy Greenhagen, a patient navigator at the Iola Clinic, who told you about a woman named Suzanne Emmons and her two granddaughters who came to her for help. What's a patient navigator?
These are the people who help you sign up for insurance on the marketplace, and they are extraordinary, extraordinary individuals inside this whole story. They are essentially, in some ways, the kind of front line in helping to determine whether or not someone could potentially qualify. And, you know, one of the patient navigators told me, basically, you have to imagine it's a marathon and a sprint and therapy all rolled into one. Every navigator I met had boxes of tissues on their desk because they often had to deliver really heartbreaking news. But they are also incredibly dedicated and will do anything and go to any lengths to really make sure that they haven't missed something. And one story that I just found in extraordinary, another navigator in the same, patient navigator in the same town, had a man come interested in purchasing insurance. He worked for a dairy farmer. And it turned out, based on his income alone, he fell into the gap, and he was pretty despondent. But they began to quiz him about what other sources of income he might have, and it turned out that he was paid in kind as well, with a side of beef and milk every week. And so the navigator realized if he were to go to a tax preparer, and that's income, and the tax preparer were to figure out what exactly that translated to in dollar terms, that would go ahead and potentially bump his income up so that he would qualify for the subsidies and tax credits. And sure enough, months, the numbers worked out, and they were able to get insurance for him. But for every story of that sort of success, there are also the stories of having to say no to someone who has just been diagnosed with cancer, having to say no to someone like Suzanne, who is taking care of her who's taking care of her two grandkids. That she
earns $13,000 a year. Doesn't that qualify her, or does having the kids disqualify her?
Yeah, because suddenly her household, her family household is larger, and therefore the amount of money that would sort of put her in a position to qualify for the subsidies is suddenly higher as well.
We're pretty much out of time, but Heidi, can you tell us about the book that you've written with other medical anthropologists called Covered, Risk, Inequality, and Experiences of Health Reform in the United States?
Sure. We wanted to, our intent was to understand that the law really did want to affect positive change and reduce inequality and bring health care to those who are unable to access either public programs or afford private insurance coverage. But what we saw is that the rollout actually, we learned a couple of lessons. We saw that people across the United States, and especially when you compare the non-expanding states with the expansion states, people do want and need affordable health care coverage. But we also see that resentment was generated in some cases because of difficult enrollment processes, complicated, laws around who qualifies and so forth. And, we kind of trace how that law became unpopular and unusable for many people and how it directly impacted the law's success and how it, fed into some of the rhetoric that we saw in the recent election. We do remain hopeful, and we do want to uphold sort of the intentions of the law, which is to reduce some of this inequality and offer suggestions for how it could be improved based on the lessons learned of the past couple of years.
Inara, you have a book coming out from Norton in July of next year, Among the Living and the Dead, A Tale of Exile and Homecoming on the War Roads of Europe. That's not about Medicaid or the Affordable Care Act.
No, it's not. It's centered around Latvia and my family's particular story post-World War II. But it does center around people in some cases trying to make the best situation in a place where no one was meant to live.
Inara Verzemnik's article, Life in Obamacare's Dead Zone, was in the December 11th issue of the New York Times Magazine. She's a journalist, assistant professor in the nonfiction writing program at the University of Iowa. We've also been speaking with Professor Heidi Castaneda, a medical anthropologist at the University of South Florida. She's contributed to a new book from NYU Press called Covered, Risk, Inequality, and Experiences of Health Reform in the United States. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you for having me.